This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
And I'm Ngofen Mputubwele.
Ngofen is one of the producers on our show, and he's here to introduce things. So, Ngofen, what's on deck here? What are we up to?
So today we're talking about black film. I noticed a few years ago, around 2016, that it felt like every single year there was a big black movie coming out that I was looking forward to.
Just the one?
Just one. 2016 was Moonlight. 2017 was Get Out. 2018 was Black Panther. Then TV2, like 2019, was Watchmen. And I was very curious at a certain point, like, oh, I wonder if something, like, is something actually happening? Like, is there like a renaissance or a something happening? Or did I just like not pay attention to movies before now?
So how are we going to go about examining this and answering the questions that are central to this?
We're talking to the Oscar award-winning director, Barry Jenkins, who directed a little film called Moonlight.
Right.
We're talking to Cheryl Lee Ralph, who is on the new show Abbott Elementary. Over the course of her career, she's worked with Sidney Poitier, Lauryn Hill, and just been part of these iconic moments of black entertainment. But to start, I figured I should go to someone who actually knows film well. I talked to a film scholar, a professor at Northwestern named Amar Jean Christian. He specializes in the ways that black stories, brown stories, queer stories break into the culture through new media. So I asked Amar if something unique is happening in black film.
Yeah, it's a really great question.
And Amar said yes. And I quickly learned that there's a lot that goes into why the answer is yes.
Historically, black film rises and falls based on broader industry trends, regulation, and culture.
This idea that black film is connected to what's going on in the wider industry is really important to Amar. And he says, in order to understand the current moment, we have to step back to the very beginnings of filmmaking.
Black film in the U.S. starts in the early 1900s at the dawn of cinema. Independent film studio owners who created a lot of really exciting black films when the medium was totally new.
Amar says that after this, the classic era of Hollywood comes into being, where studios have these exclusive agreements with theaters and pretty much dictate what movies the theaters show.
We associate the classic Hollywood studio era with really conservative storytelling, and that means that black people didn't get a shot at leading films, right? Mm. If you watch the Ryan Murphy Netflix show, Hollywood, which is about that time, the whole thing was, how could a black person write a movie, you know?
Until 1948, with a Supreme Court case that breaks up the classic Hollywood studio system.
Yeah, the breakup of the studio system forces the studios to figure out what the audience actually wants. When they don't have these exclusive, really controlling relationships with the theaters that show movies, right, they actually have to figure out, what do people want to buy tickets to? Because before, they would just tell people, these are your movies. You know, these are your options. This is all you have. And so by 1960, they start making edgier films. They start making films starring younger people with more violence, more sex. And that kind of works for a little bit, but it really isn't until the 70s when they've really hit rock bottom and their revenues are really struggling that they try putting black movies in theaters. And of course, there's more independent theaters happening right now. So theaters just end up showing these really low budget films starring black people, and they just kill at the box office.
Tamara Dobson, the Soul Sisters' answer to James Bond, and the most exciting new star in years, 6 feet two of dynamite.
Because of course, by the 1970s, black people haven't had films for like an entire generation, you know, on cinemas. So there are a hugely underserved audience, and it ends up stabilizing Hollywood's revenues. Of course, blaxploitation kind of crystallizes these edgy black stories with violence and sex, and Hollywood makes a lot of money off of that.
Right on, sweet sister.
Man, that broad is 10 miles of bad road.
And it ends up stabilizing the business until the 80s when they invent the blockbuster, right? You have Jaws and Star Wars in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. And then Hollywood figures out, oh, we can just put blockbusters in cinema. And that becomes the thing in the 80s. Big budgets, special effects, big stars, or Oscar films. And then in the 90s, you get quote-unquote ghetto pictures.
And sorry, just real quick, give me an example of a film in that genre.
Quote-unquote ghetto pictures? Boys in the Hood.
Okay, got it. Yep.
Now what we need to do is we need to keep everything in our neighborhood, everything, black. Black owned with black money, just like.
So when we think about like Boys in the Hood or Belly, or even later in the 90s, like Friday, right? These were kind of Hollywood's attempt to like embrace hip hop, right? Embrace the rise of hip hop in culture, which, as Craig Watkins says, was Hollywood's response to the introduction of new media and the growth of television and people spending less time in the theaters. They always use the black audience to draw people back into theaters when they've lost the audience in some other way. And that is what's happening again now in the 2010s. I think Django Unchained was a huge hit, and that reminded Hollywood that black people like movies and that we deserve movies. And I think with that and 12 Years a Slave, which also did really well, paved the way for films like Get Out to get financed, which would have never been financed before. I think what we're seeing now in black film that we haven't seen historically, right? Every moment is a different type of genre, right? Blaxploitation was like gangs and sex. Quote unquote ghetto pictures was that, but the cities had changed. Now, of course, hip hop is mainstream, so that's not edgy anymore. So what is the new edgy thing to do in black film? I think it's genre.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be.
We're seeing Black Panther, black people in fantasy.
If there's too many white people, I get nervous.
Get Out, black people in horror, which we haven't seen in a long time.
So what I'm wondering is, in the 90s, I remember watching these shows like Martin, Living Single, In Living Color. And then in retrospect, it seems like the black shows kind of disappeared in the 2000s. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Absolutely. The story is about vertical integration. So in 1996, the federal government passed the Telecommunications Act, and that allowed media companies to buy more media companies. All of a sudden, if you were pitching a TV show in Hollywood, right, you needed to get not only the president of the studio and the president of the network to say yes, but then their boss and their boss's boss to say yes. And because of racism, there's just always going to be some person who's like, no, that's too risky. I don't want to do that. And that didn't really change until the ratings had gotten so bad that they finally had to just try new things and let Shonda Rhimes make Scandal, right? And let A24 do 12 Years a Slave and release that widely in theaters, and Django Unchained with Tarantino. And finally, the numbers don't lie, right? The ratings don't lie. The box office numbers don't lie. And they will follow those trends. But in the meantime, it just became an industry-wide shutout in the 2000s, which is why you had people making web series, by the way, right? This is my entry point into this conversation. Why does Issa Rae make a web series on her own in the year 2011? And it's because she couldn't pitch that show to Hollywood.
Awkward moment. What's the protocol for repeatedly running into someone at a stop sign?
She missed you.
Oh my God.
Hey, I totally didn't even see you.
It's been so long.
I know, right?
No, seriously. What the fuck is it?
Lo and behold, this low-budget web series made for, like, no money has millions of views on YouTube, and Hollywood is like, oh, right, the black audience. We forgot about y'all. Welcome back, you know?
Right. And who is going and saying sort of like, our numbers are too low, now let's introduce black film? Like, kind of like what I mean is, like, what is the mechanics of that? Is it like intentional? Is it nefarious? Is it like how does the mechanics of that work?
It's a confluence of factors. It usually is a visionary director or producer who manages to get someone to give them money to make something that ends up getting seen and shows the industry that there's money to be made. And once there's a hit, the industry will follow. For the 20-teens, I really think it was Django Unchained.
Amongst your inventory, I've been led to believe it's a specimen I'm keen to acquire.
What's your name?
Django.
Then you're exactly the one I'm looking for.
Hey, no sale.
Because it made so much money globally. It just made so much money. And it was such a racially charged storyline that the industry hadn't tried before, a story about slavery. Mm-hmm. And of course, who was that? It was a white director that was able to do that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So how does this wave get started? Well, white men always have access. So sometimes it's them. They try something. A lot of the directors of blaxploitation films were white people, right? Were white men who were able to get the capital to do it.
So if the current moment has given us these films like Get Out, like a huge horror film, and other movies kind of like Underground Railroad, the TV show, things about racism, things about slavery, things about like these kind of big high concept issues. Does that affect the kinds of stories that one tells in the sense that like essentially your story must be sort of like big to succeed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it really puts a constraint on artists who want to tell stories about the Black everyday, about Black love, about Black parenting, right? About Blackness outside of trauma. So much of the moment right now is compelling artists to tell stories about the most difficult parts of the Black experience, which is important, right? We have to tell the stories about our pain and our trauma because that's very real and it affects our lives. But a lot of Black viewers are pushing back now and saying, well, why do I need to be triggered and re-traumatized every time I want to go to the theater or go to watch a TV show? You know, can't I just have a nice story about two Black people falling in love and that's it? Like, do we need more stories about how we are attacked and violence? Maybe, but I think we also need stories about solidarity, about how to love each other, about how to heal. And I just don't think that this hyper-capitalist, hyper-competitive environment is really incentivizing that kind of storytelling. And I think it could have cultural effects that really prevent us from healing, from building together, from connecting with each other outside of our trauma.
Film scholar Amar Jean-Christian, talking with the Radio Hour's Gofen Emputobuele. In a moment, I'll also chat with Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Vladimir Putin has invaded Ukraine, launching what could be the largest war in Europe since the end of the Second World War. And on our podcast feed this week, executive editor and Politics and More host Dorothy Wickenden speaks with Washington correspondent and former Moscow correspondent Susan Glasser about how the United States and its allies can respond.
You know, I don't want to downplay the nature of these sanctions, but I think Putin has also shown his willingness to take that as the price for Ukraine, you know, that he has baked that into his calculation and his decision to go ahead with the invasion.
You can hear that conversation in the New Yorker Radio Hour feed, wherever you get your podcasts. And on this week's show, we're talking about the current moment in Black movies and television. The 2016 film Moonlight wasn't a blockbuster like, say, Get Out or Black Panther, but in a way, it was every bit as monumental. It's a subtle, intimate portrayal of Chiron, a character we see as a boy and then as a young man struggling to understand his sexuality as he comes of age during the crack epidemic.
Where are you from, Chiron? You live with your mama?
Yes.
What about your daddy? You want us to take you home then, after you get finished eating your food?
No.
Okay. You can stay here tonight. Would you like that? Okay.
Moonlight won Best Picture at the Oscars, of course, and a host of other awards. It also made Barry Jenkins one of the most celebrated young directors out there. Jenkins went on to do an adaptation of James Baldwin's book, If Beale Street Could Talk, as well as the Amazon series The Underground Railroad, based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Colson Whitehead. In interviews, you've said that projects like Moonlight and Underground Railroad start years and years before they ever come out in film. What was happening in the culture 10 or so years ago so that projects like Moonlight, Underground Railroad, or Respect, King Richard, Black Panther, Get Out, would all come to fruition in these past 6 years? What was happening in terms of the culture and maybe in terms of the business?
You know, it's interesting. 10 years ago would have been 2012, so it would have been at the tail end of the first term of Barack Obama's presidency. And I remember I made my first film came out in the inaugural year of that presidency in 2008. And it was just really interesting to be a young Black person, a young Black creative in a time in this country where if you look to the highest office in the land, there was a Black person. And there was a lot of things happening in the film industry. You know, I think Ava made her first film, or her second film, excuse me, around that time and won.
Ava DuVernay.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I forget that these people are my friends, but but they're icons to folks listening. But yeah, Ava won. She won the directing prize at Sundance, and, you know, Ryan Coogler had Fruitvale. There was just so much going on. Justin Simeon had Dear White People. There was just so much happening.
Are you saying the Obama presidency was like a kind of inspiration or permission that hadn't been there before?
I wouldn't say permission. Absolutely not. I wouldn't say that. But I do think it's interesting. The president of the United States is a very visible person. To have to see this person every single day, because the news coverage was intense. It meant that if you walked into any room, you know, this wasn't going to be the first time someone had to see someone like me walk into that room, and they weren't going to be surprised or taken aback, you know, by the things that we had to say, by the things that we wanted. By the things that we wanted to do. And I think so much work had been done in the decade prior, I must say, you know, people like Tino Ngenda, who's an executive over at Netflix, you know, rising up, you know, all these different people that when the opportunity presented itself, there were just so many folks. It was undeniable, I would say.
So what you're suggesting in a way is that it changed the atmosphere in the rooms that we don't see, moviegoers don't see. In other words, offices in downtown LA at agencies and studios?
I would say that absolutely. Change the atmosphere is a wonderful way to say it. And I think also, too, the energy with which people entered those rooms was just different. Now, I wasn't around in the 90s. I wasn't around in the 80s. I can imagine what it was like for Spike to always be the first, the only person stepping into those rooms and not adjusting, not amending who he was when he was in those rooms. And yet he made such great work, you know, despite the atmosphere, as you put it.
That's Spike Lee you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And against certain odds. And maybe going back to talking about Mr. Obama, perhaps, yes, just seeing, constantly seeing this image, maybe it reaffirmed the need to be committed, you know, to being ourselves in that adjusted atmosphere.
I think if you were to ask a Black American writer about what canon he or she learned from, they would, it would differ radically from writer to writer, but they would be looking to, just as anybody from any identity would, Black writing, whether it's Wright or Baldwin or Zora Neale Hurston or on and on and on, but also available to him or her is Melville and Jane Austen or whatever it is. As a filmmaker, what's the canon for you, particularly when it comes to Black American film, as constricted as it was by circumstance?
One, I think for any Black person who grew up the way I did, the original canon are your elders. You know, sitting at the kitchen table with my grandma and her drinking the Sanka coffee, you know, on Sundays, making us sit there and telling stories about her childhood. She grew up in South Carolina. That's one canon. And then when I think of cinema, you know, it's interesting. I didn't realize this until I was an adult and I was studying cinema, but a lot of the Black cinema canon that I loved, I didn't realize was directed by white directors. You know, I'm talking about, because as a kid, you know, you're watching Coming to America, you're mm-hmm. watching The Color Purple. You know, these are things that my grandma watched. And these are movies that are directed by white people. That was sort of the canon growing up. And then once I started to interrogate for myself, you know, what's behind those images, what's inside these images, it was Spike, man. You know, I can't lie, it was Spike. As far as the black canon of cinema images, and then Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep was the one when I first saw that, it was like, okay, cool, this is a lightning rod. I understand where I need to go now.
I want to ask you a particular aesthetic question. Throughout your work, you prioritize lighting, something that not everybody thinks about. What's the role of light in your films, and what's the process you go through with your collaborator and cinematographer, James Laxton, and your colorist, Alex Bickel, to light actors and scenes in a way that's become so iconic in your work?
You know, part of it, I'm working from memory. You know, I think one of the things that's really beautiful about cinema and about filmmaking is you're kind of using all these earthbound tools to capture the feeling of consciousness, you know, and to capture this wave of memories. And the way I remember black folks' skin, the way I remember black folks standing in certain kinds of light, you know, that's what Bickel and myself and James Laxton, that's what we strive for always. This is a very privileged art form, though, which I mean, it's very damn expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
And it always has been. You know, it's less expensive now. And I think these tools, in addition to one, it's almost like jazz, David. It's like jazz. You know, I tell this story of being in Argentina. Since you mentioned Mr. Obama's first election, I was in. I literally flew to Argentina the morning after he won that race. And I get there to screen my first film, and I end up in this group of Argentine intellectuals, and they're talking about what has America ever given to the world? Because everybody's trying to knock me back down. I'm so proud that we have a black president. And they're like, nothing's actually created in America. And then he said, oh, but there is jazz. America created jazz. And I was like, yeah, we did. And then to me, because again, these was a bunch of white Argentines, they said, and you know what? And your people did that. You know, and they explained to me, the instruments existed, but they were used to play classical standards and things like that. But as the instruments made their way into the hands of black folks, the sound that came out of them stretched and mutated. I think with these digital tools of cinema, I think something very similar is happening in the field that we work in. And again, 40 years ago, someone from my background, it would be a much longer journey to get to the point where I could take control of these tools. You mentioned my colorist, Alex Bickel, and the cinematographer, James Laxton. We use these German cameras, and when it comes to you, it's just a brain, and you program how it reads light. You program what color tones it prioritizes. You program, you know, how it's going to reflect the curve, the highlights, and the shadows, and things like that. And so when we approach these images that are telling the stories of my ancestors and the people I grew up with, we program it to see them, to prioritize how they look in the light.
Barry, another thing that seems very important to you, in addition to light, is, naturally enough, sound. A film teacher once told you that images are only 50% of the experiences of watching a film, and the score is the other 50%, which seems like a lot. You and your composer, Nicholas Britell, obviously take that greatly to heart. Can you tell me about the scores for Moonlight and the Underground Railroad? What sort of worlds did you want to build into those projects in terms of sound?
Yeah. I'll start by saying, just paying respect to Richard Portman, who was the film professor you're referring to. He was the first person I ever met who won an Oscar, and he had his Oscar. He won an Oscar for, he worked with Altman in the 70s, and they created this process of multi-tracking all these dialogue tracks. And he was the one who said that. He's like, Barry, you guys come in here all day and you focus on the image, 99%. And then you just bullshit the last 1% of sound. He said films are half image and half sound. So shout out to him.
Did he get the percentages right? Is it half? Really?
You know, sometimes, depending on the scene, you know, it can be 99. You know, there's a scene in my first film where the screen goes nearly completely black. You just see a silhouette and you hear right. The voice, you know, of this narrative spoken. So it depends. But I say, you know, Mr. Portman passed away right before Moonlight was nominated at the Academy Awards, but it was beautiful. He was in the honorarium at the ceremony, and we ended up winning Best Picture, so shout out to Richard Portman. But yeah, it's so important. When you're in a cinema, the screen is in front of you. The speakers are everywhere, everywhere. And sound, just like when you're eating food or you're drinking a wine, the taste is important, but the smell is just as important. I think in cinema, the sound is just as important. It's that sniff of wine before you taste it, you know? That's what the speakers are to me. And especially with Moonlight in particular, that character doesn't express himself verbally quite a bit, but the audience is hearing everything he hears. And so both myself and Nick and then our sound folks, Annalie Blank and Matt Waters, we go into it going, how can we help the audience understand what this person is feeling right now, basically at all moments?
Let your head rest in my hand. Relax. I got you, I promise. I'm not gonna let you go. Hey, man, I got you. There you go. 10 seconds. That right there? You're in the middle of the world, man. That's good. More athletic. There you go. Yeah. I think you're ready. Think we got a swimmer.
You wanna try?
You ready to swim? Go.
For myself in particular, you know, as a black storyteller, I'm always just trying to get closer to myself, close to the truth of who I am and the creation of these images, which can sometimes be very difficult. And so I look to the work of others. Every time I get a chance to, I want to speak someone else's name who is working in a way that inspires me, who is telling black stories that either I am not telling or I can't tell. Because I think collectively, as we all tell our individual stories, we're just building out this tapestry of hopefully getting at the ineffable process of understanding or expressing what it is to be black in the world today.
Barry Jenkins, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, it's my pleasure.
Barry Jenkins, director of the 2016 film Moonlight and the Amazon series The Underground Railroad. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're looking today at black film and television, at some of the shows and movies that are defining the cultural conversation at the moment. And it seems that in recent years, like a real floodgate has opened to some tremendous successes, commercial as well as critical, and they're centered on black experience. This certainly doesn't come out of nowhere. To get some perspective, staff writer Vincent Cunningham recently sat down with the actor Cheryl Lee Ralph. Here's Vincent.
So even if you think that you don't know Cheryl Lee Ralph, I would bet that you do. She has been a staple of black television and movies for decades, and she's been present at some amazing moments of American entertainment. She played Dena Jones in the original cast of Dreamgirls 40 years ago. She was in Sister Act 2 with Lauryn Hill and Whoopi Goldberg, which was just a huge movie for black audiences and one of my all-time favorites to this day. And she's now in Abbott Elementary, a new sitcom on ABC.
I wanted to get your expert classy eye on my rug request email to Ava.
Janine, we are not getting new rugs. We are not getting anything.
Barbara, Have some faith. Ava literally said she'll get us whatever we need.
Janine and I have been working in the Philadelphia School District for 20 years, and Ava is just the latest in a long line of people who do absolutely nothing.
Cheryl Lee Ralph's career started in the 1970s, so she's seen a lot of entertainment history, but she's also made a lot of history of her own along the way.
I came into the industry as a teenager. I was 19 years old. I had just graduated from Rutgers, and my first movie was with Sidney Poitier called Piece of the Action. Mr. Poitier was one of the most kind, most wonderful human beings towards me as a young artist. He wanted my success, and true to being a real girl dad, he said, "You are so deeply talented. I wish this industry had more to offer you." But in the time that I was on the set with him, he gave me every great thing he had in reference to being on the set and what it took to be a great artist, you know, in control of your art, of yourself. And he was very funny. He said, "It's interesting." He said, "You'll probably grow up to be a beautiful woman," because I was a teenager then, you know? And he said, "A beautiful female actress has a difficult time." I didn't quite understand what that meant, but I kind of understood it, that, you know, back then when you're still breaking these, you know, these walls down and perception of what talent looks like, you know, and can you be easy on the eye and smart too, you know, and still be a dramatic actress, you know? And, you know, he was very upfront that, you know, films were so far and few between then, but television turned out to be, television and theater, you know, they were welcoming. But anyway, it was hard. It was hard.
No.
But I wouldn't not do it again.
One thing I do want to ask you is just how it has been to continue to make those switches between movies, TV, theater. It's something that seems to only recently have been open really to most actors and actresses, but certainly to Black actors and actresses, this sort of triple threat career that you've had. How has that been just in terms of managing those different parts of your creativity and also, you know, the different parts of a career as you're building it?
You know, it's very interesting. Going from stage to TV to film, they're very different approaches to your acting. On stage, you eat the furniture. You just eat the furniture. Mm. Because the people all the way in the back have to see what you're doing. And the further you get back, the smaller those images get. When you're on film, you polish the furniture. Mm. You polish it so that it shines and it's beautiful and it's lovely to look at. When you're doing TV, you put the furniture on display. Mm. So they're very different approaches. So I think that's how I do it. That's how I'm able to go from one thing to one thing. So when people say you do it all, I'm like, yeah, I actually do.
So what we're going to do, we're going to walk through some highlights from your career so far. I want to play a piece of audio for you. And when you hear it, I just want to hear your immediate reaction, just how it makes you feel and what is it you remember about this moment.
Okay.
And so our tribute to the musical legacy of the Imperial Theater has brought us up to the present evening. The incumbent musical is, of course, Dreamgirls, a splashy tour de force with the most up-to-date razzle-dazzle the Broadway Theater has to offer. And it's a nominee for Best Musical. On this scene, the girl's been fired from a risingly successful singing group. She's been fired by the group's manager, her former lover.
Curtis was supposed to
love me. Curtis was supposed to love me.
Happy, please. Stop excusing yourself. You've been late, you've been mean, and getting
fatter all the time.
Now you're lying, you're lying. I've never been so thin. You're lying, because you're sleeping with that girl who thinks she's better than everybody. She ain't better than anybody. She ain't nothing but common.
Now you listen to me, Miss Blame It on the World. See, I put up with you for much too long. I have put up with your bitching. I put up with your nagging and all of your
Wow.
So this is the Tony Awards night in 1982, and it's a role that introduces you to not only the American theater, but a lot of Americans and people across the world.
Wow. You know, that was very weird what you just did, because you said, tell me, I just want your reaction. And I followed you in that thought process. Then when I realized where it was, I literally put myself in the position of that night. I knew that if I was standing on stage, getting ready to be a part of this moment, and we had been nominated Best Musical Young Black Folks on Broadway, doing highbrow theater, not just a review, but a script that we all had a part in writing as artists. We were about ready to do something major. People may not know how deep of a connection we each had to that script, to that show, but we as young Black people under 30 were about to do something major, and we did.
Wow.
I entered that moment and I was just like, remember this right here, because very few artists will ever get what you're about to receive. Hmm. Yeah. And I was right.
What do you remember about that night? Just, was it a buildup all day? How were you just living into that night?
First of all, there was so much that went into having the perfect gown for after the show, the guests, you know, getting my parents there. I'm an immigrant's child, and my Jamaican mother was just appalled that I was going to be a singer, a dancer, an actress after they worked their good hard-earned money to send me to college to make history at Rutgers University, and you're going to be an actress? It was such a journey to get her in the seat, whereas my father, my American father, was like, you are born alone with the assistance of your mother. You will die alone with the assistance of yourself. If this is what you want to do, do it, love it, enjoy it, and I will be right there beside you. Mm. So he and I were sitting together. My mother was sitting behind us, and she was the first. She was, of course, the one to say, yes, the one, Dina Jones, that's my daughter. Yes, that's my daughter. She's been nominated for this Tony Award. It was just like in a movie. It was crazy. And then, you know, they pull you out to go on stage to get dressed. And it was just crazy, because we were also caught in between a time where you've got Tony Randall, you've got Dick Cavett, and you've got all of these other groups of artsy people who are part of a different time. The newscaster, what was his name? I forget his name, but when my parents were coming backstage, he looked at my parents and he said, oh my, the Black bourgeois has arrived. And I thought, oh my God, they were stuck in the fact that did theater have to change this much with us taking our bow on Broadway? Do you understand what I mean? We tore up.
It does.
Yeah, we tore up the theater. We literally helped tear up the theater, so much so that when Miss Saigon came around and they came from the back of the theater with the helicopter descending on stage, that hearkened to, well, they broke the theater with Broadway, and now they're just opening up the theater wide. And for me, you know, don't ask me why I think like this, I think that sometimes in order for institutions, which it's not really, places, which it's not really, communities, which it is, like Broadway, in order for them to make room, truly make room for others, you got to break it down.
Yeah.
You've got to break it down because you've got to help people see things differently outside of their own vision. And even if it's 2020, it's not perfect.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, as you say, this production is so personal to all of you in it.
Yeah.
And then it's hitting the whole world.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, there's you in the, you're in the middle of this. And like, what were you in your career going into that production? And what kind of, what did this give you a new sense of what you wanted to do as you moved forward in your career?
It didn't give me a new sense of what I had to do. It just showed me what I had to do. In some ways, I struggled because as an artist, it wasn't so much about being an artist as much as it was about being a good human. Entertainment, show business, TV, no matter what, can be very, very hard on people. It's an industry built upon rejection. I mean, for me alone, and I've said it often, I've been too tall, too short, too black, and not black enough all in one day. All in one day. I had someone, they didn't like me because I reminded them of their ex-wife. I had one person say, her legs are too full. They should be thinner. I was like, oh my God, they are talking about this. And then once they start talking about your features, you know, that you're too black. And sometimes that means so many things. They don't like your shade. They don't like your features. Oh, they don't like your hair texture. And it's all the things that can really break down a human. And for me to be chosen as one of the most beautiful, it was just like, wow. It was like absolute total revenge because we were dreams just the way we were. And Tom Ion did something that most people never, ever get about the show. It's about the triumph of the dark girl. It's about the triumph of the dark black girl. It's about the triumph of the black girl who you're not going to look at her and think she's something other than what she is, a melanated young black queen.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not until the second act of the show, when commercialism, where the industry gets their hands on the group, that they want to put in the milkier, light-skinned girl.
Right.
They miss what that means. They miss it every time. He was making a statement that these three black girls had to make it, no matter what the country, America, thought about them, that black girls in that time, the 60s, were beautiful and acceptable. And they could sing, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Speaking of singing,
yeah,
I'm going to play another piece of audio for you.
Okay.
And I want to do the same thing. Just tell me how it makes you feel.
Okay.
Joyful, joyful Lord.
Oh, gosh. I am looking at another incredible talent.
The amazing Lauryn Hill in Sister Act 2.
Yeah. A beautiful young girl who was full of confidence, who literally took me from what I had gone through in the development of Dreamgirls and everything before it to this moment to look back and see baby me. Not completely me, but it was a trajectory that I could see that was important from artist to artist, human to human, young black queen to young black queen. She sat there one day in between breaks and Lauryn looked at me and Lauryn said, Miss Ralph, because now what is it? 11 years have passed and this girl says, Miss Ralph, I am going to have a group and we're going to be called the Fugees.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to be big, Miss Ralph. And I was like, you are going to be big. You're going to be big as soon as this movie happens.
Oh, I have to tell you, when I was in, when I was, you know, my youth choir at church sang that song and did the dance, and you know, it was so important to me growing up. Just thinking, you know, it was a wonderful. It's funny that you didn't know that it was such. Had such an impact, because I definitely felt it.
Oh my God. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Like you said, I mean, it's 11 years after Dreamgirls. I wonder, just in that span, like you talked about how much of a breakthrough Dreamgirls was and that kind of representation. And now you're in a movie that's pushing forward a similar kind of just representation. Like, as you said, you, Whoopi Goldberg, Lauryn Hill. Was there a difference? Did it feel like there was more space for this kind of thing once you get to that Sister Act 2 moment, in just in terms of people being more open to those kinds of representations?
Oh,
how was the cultural feeling?
You could feel it. You could feel it. But I have to tell you that when I left Dreamgirls to, you know, to pursue TV and film, you know, it wasn't the same welcome that folks might have gotten from, say, the cast of Hamilton, you know, where arms mm-hmm. were open. For us, I'll never forget my first big Hollywood casting director meeting. And he looked at me and he said, "You're a beautiful black girl. Everybody knows it. But what do I do with a talented, beautiful black girl? Do I put you in a movie with Tom Cruise? Do you kiss? Who goes to see that movie? What do I do with you?" Now, I'm telling you, that alone could defeat an artist. But when I left that room, I said to myself, everybody knows that I'm a talented, beautiful black girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I deserve to be in movies with the likes of a Tom Cruise. But these people are afraid of the magic that I've got. So I've got to carry on and make it work for me.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. That's what I had to take out of that, because I was like, you are not going to break my spirit just because you don't know what to do with me.
Yeah.
So by the time you've got Sister Act 2 coming along, and you've got this 16-year-old young woman, you've got Whoopi, you know, that was, and black women, and you're showing people braiding their hair on TV and all of that. Those were little wonderful moments of representation once again.
You say that you got out of that interview, that audition, and you just kind of spoke to yourself. You spoke some courage back into yourself. As you mentioned, there are people who have been crushed by those things and haven't been able to give themselves that speech. What were the resources in you that made you do that? Was it your girl? Was it your upbringing? What helped you soldier on in that moment?
I really do think it's being an immigrant's child. You know, you've got. Yeah, my mother was like, look, this is where you are. This is America. Let's get out there. Mm-hmm. There are things to be done, like thriving. She, you know, that whole thing about just surviving,
right.
That was not what she wanted for her children. You know, you can't not survive. You must survive. And better than that, you must thrive. So I think right. I got the message from them. Quite clearly, you know, I'll never forget my mother telling me, fixing my dress for school when little girls used to wear cotton. And she fixed my dress, and she said to me, I can see her saying to me, "We are in America. And here they will smile in your face and stab you in your back. Mm. So you must have eyes back a front." So what that basically meant was, this was treacherous. This is treacherous territory right here. And you little four-year-old going to kindergarten, you must have eyes in the front and back of your head, because they're coming for you.
Your mom was a fashion designer, correct?
That's correct.
And she created the famous Kariba suit. It's like made famous by the great Jamaican Prime Minister Michael Manley.
Oh my God, really did your research, didn't you? Yes.
Well, I have to tell you, my wife is Jamaican, and therefore Michael Manley is a saint in my household.
You tell her, say, I love her.
She loves you too.
Thank you.
But I do wonder, thinking about that, your mom using art to make a kind of, in some ways, making real political change. It seems to me like that's what I've always thought about with that suit.
Wow.
And I wonder if you have thought of your art in a similar way. There's all these great films and TV shows. You can think about Abbott Elementary. You can think about films of the last couple of years like Moonlight and Get Out and Black Panther, all these things.
Yeah.
I wonder if you think that there's a connection between the sort of still growing and certainly imperfect, but still growing presence of Black people in popular art.
I think it goes back to what you said earlier, what we were talking about, family. You can't really get rid of your family. You are who you are. You are your people's people. And I had never thought of that. But my mother said that as a child, she would look at Black men going into court, going into church, you know, the judges sitting up there, and they were always sweating with this shirt, with this tie, with this wool jacket. And she said, the sun is hot. We come from a hot country. Where is our pride? We can't go to these places sweating. Our men need a different look. And she created what is, you know, very much now known, as you'll see a lot of it, the bush jacket, or you'll see it in lighter fabrics in they call it like the Cuban shirt.
Yeah.
Quite literally, my mother was putting the world of Black people in all of its shades and powers and languages right in front of me, trying to get Black men to understand, you don't have to sweat like that. You can look. You can go into court and the UN and present yourself like a man to be respected and not sweating in their shirt and tie. This is for you.
Yeah.
You know, but I really do think that things like that come from your parents. It's like my dad, you know, with music. It was always, remember when all we had was one note? Remember when all we had was just the drum? We were our own telephone, internet, iPhone, Android. We were it for ourselves in how we brought our art with us to communicate for the change that is still happening now with us using the bare minimum. Can you,
yeah.
I mean, the things that we have achieved with what we've had to be up against and are still against as those things try to rear their ugly heads once again, we cannot forget our art, because at one point that was all we could bring with us.
Hmm. Thank you so much. I mean, it seems to me that that's exactly what you and others like you have done. You just show what's possible through your art. And I just want to thank you for talking with us. You can't imagine how much I appreciate it.
Thank you. And tell your wife I said, big up yourself.
I will.
That's The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham speaking to Cheryl Lee Ralph. And you can see her on ABC's Abbott Elementary. I hope you enjoyed the show. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Harrison Keithline and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine.
And we had additional help this week from Rhiannon Corby.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.